When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Scenes from the gold mine. Everyone has a dream. Some have the talent to make it come true, but only a few have the courage to try.
We didn't give you everything you asked for. You couldn't afford to play this artist crap.
I don't ask for anything.
I want to be a musician.
You think I'll set the music industry on fire?
Debbie D'Angelo has the desire and the ambition to reach the top.
You want the gig?
Yeah.
Scenes from the Goldmine is a 1987 film written and directed by Mark Rocco and starring Catherine Mary Stewart, Cameron Dye, Steve Railsback, and Joe Pantoliano. The film is about a band called Niles Dresden and the Pieces. At the beginning of the film, Catherine Mary Stewart's character, Debbie D'Angelo, joins the band. She is replacing a previous keyboardist, who is actually played in the film by Bruce Springsteen's sister, Pamela Springsteen. The bassist in the Pieces is played by Timothy B. Schmidt from the Eagles, and the drummer is played by John Ford Coley, who, with his partner England Dan, was responsible for the nightmarish earworm, I'd Really Love to See You Tonight. Debbie D'Angelo is a struggling songwriter whose parents want her to get a real job. She has a depressed brother and roommate problems, but things are looking up when she joins this band and they land a record deal. Unfortunately, Niles Dresden and his manager, Joe Pantoliano, end up taking advantage of her, and the whole thing falls apart. Scenes from the Goldmine, in my opinion, is not a great film. But what's really special about it are the songs. This film is chock full of great songs which are performed by the band in the film. Now, if you want to see the film, I uploaded it to YouTube, and there will be links at the blog page and on Facebook, or if you just search Scenes from the Goldmine 1987 on YouTube, you'll find it. The film is not available anywhere. I don't think it's ever been released on DVD. You cannot stream it. So the only way to get this movie was on VHS. And I talked about the film on the direct-to-video episode that I did a while back. Anyways, you might want to stop the episode here and watch the film if you're interested, or watch it later afterwards, but you'll have a better understanding of what me and Cameron are talking about, I guess, if you watch the film beforehand. But like I said, it's not a great film, but it's fun to watch, and the music in the movie is great. But yeah, on today's episode, you're going to hear a conversation I had with the man who plays Niles Dresden, the leader of the band. His name is Cameron Dye. He's an actor and a musician. Cameron was in several movies in the 80s that revolved around music. He played Nicolas Cage's buddy Fred in Valley Girl. And he played Lorenzo Lamas' DJ in a very strange film called Body Rock. And then in 87, he was in Scenes from the Goldmine. So it wasn't a successful movie, and for that reason or for other reasons, a soundtrack album for this movie was never released. And that is very unfortunate. That's a tragedy, in my opinion. Because like I've said, the songs in this movie are great. And we talk a lot about the songs and where they came from. And you'll get to hear every song, pretty much, from the movie you'll get to hear on this episode, sprinkled in throughout the conversation. Cameron Dye is a great singer, performs these songs really well, so I would love to have a soundtrack for this film, but at least because the songs are played, you know, the majority of the songs feature in the film in almost full-length versions, at least we get to hear the music. You know, ripped from the VHS tape. You get to hear these songs, and you'll hear them in this episode. So like I said, if you want to see the movie, I uploaded it to YouTube. Just search Scenes from the Goldmine 1987 on YouTube, and you'll find it. And this is the conversation I had with the star of Scenes from the Goldmine, actor and musician Cameron Dye.
Now we're going to try something. Don't get nervous, okay?
Try something.
Do the same thing. Try it like this.
Here, right?
right?
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's on the chorus. I'm going to do the verses the same way you were doing it.
Well, I guess I was thinking about starting by just asking you, like, what year did you move to Los Angeles?
Oh, man. I came, I started UCLA in 1977.
Okay.
Fall of 77.
So, were you into the whole music scene then?
Yeah, I'd always, you know, I've always gone back and forth. When I moved to California from Toledo when I was 16.
Okay.
So, I was 75. And I'd seen the Rolling Stones that summer, and that was it, man. I wanted to be Mick Jagger, you know. I mean, that was what I wanted to do. And then I had a great teacher in high school up in Northern California in Millbrae named Alan Knight, and he got me just kind of going on acting. And I'd always, you know, I'd always been interested in that too. So, you know, I mean, a lot of my process, you know, for the last 40 years has been kind of flipping back and forth between the two things. And, at some point, I just accepted, okay, you do both. Just kind of do it.
Right.
Because for a period, there was like one or the other. It's like, well, I'm doing this now. And, you know, and I would kind of wipe out anything that would come my way the other way. So, you know, I do them both. I used to sing in bands growing up. And then I've had my own band here in L.A. for the last 20 years. So, you know, I continue to write and sing. Yeah, music's still an intense passion of mine.
That doesn't surprise me that you pursued both music and acting, because you can tell just from the movie, obviously you play guitar really well and you have a good voice and, you know, you're a good performer. All of that is apparent in the film, so.
Well, that's funny. I was, you know, of course, faking the guitar to somebody else. The guy who played guitar was, I just remember his name is Fitz. I don't remember his full name. Great guitar player. And you know, up to that point, any bands I was in, I just sang. So I didn't have that responsibility of playing guitar, even though I played guitar since I was young. You know, these days I play guitar in my band. But yeah, I was faking the guitar in that movie, but I did the singing.
But the scene where Catherine's at the keyboard and she's playing Don't Let Him Know for the first time, that was you playing guitar there along with her, right?
No, I just faked it.
Well, wow.
I had the playback to work with, but you know, put it this way. I mean, I am a guitar player, so I kind of knew how to fake somebody else's guitar playing. Well, you know, I know where the fingers go and all that stuff.
Yeah, you fooled me.
Yeah, even though but the one thing I did definitely, I'm not a lead player. I've always been a rhythm player, great rhythm banger, and I know Chuck Berry riffs and stuff, but. Put it this way, I sounded a lot better than I am.
Okay. So if you moved to LA in 77, so then that's right when like the whole power pop and the punk scene and all that was going on. Were you going to the clubs and seeing bands?
Yeah, I went to a lot of clubs around that time, and you know, my favorite LA band was the Plimsolls. Love them. Yeah. And then I got to work with them, you know, in Valley Girl, but right. That was after I was already a big fan. In fact, I had a band kind of covering Plimsoll songs up north. So yeah, them, who were the other bands I would see back then? The funny thing about the 80s for me, a lot of it I missed because I was digging further into the 60s and the 80s. I mean, I was going back and picking up all the stuff that I missed. You know, I grew up as a kid in the 60s, but I started listening to music when I was 4 or 5. You know, like when the Beatles came out, I was there glued to the TV, like, wow, that changed everything. So I was still, you know, in the 80s, I found myself going back and picking up like Animals and Van Morrison and them and, you know, those British bands that I remember hearing early on that did like American R&B. I love that. Stones, I'm still a big Stones fan, but, you know, especially the early stuff. So, you know, when people ask me about the music in the 80s, I mean, that's a lot of what I was listening to was 60s stuff that I missed the first time around.
Right.
And the similarity with the 60s and the 80s, you know, the 20-year cycles, it's always 20 years later. You go 20 years back and that's what was going on. But a lot of one-hit bands, great one-hit bands in the 60s, as well as the 80s, you know, I'm trying to think of some. And then they... You know, my favorite 80s songs, besides Million Miles Away, I think is an anthem. Welcome to the Boomtown. I mean, Dave and David, they had one album, but it was a great album. Of course, Melt With You, Modern English, you know, I mean, two of my top three songs were in the Valley Girl soundtrack.
Right.
And, you know, for no other reason, but they were just, to me, they were great songs and fit the decade. I would spend a lot of times in the clubs just cause, I mean, it was, you know, where I felt kind of comfortable during the time.
Well, you had the Knack coming out of there at that time. And like,
yeah, I saw them once they had already hit up in Berkeley. You know, there was that one album that did everything for them. And sadly, after that, no real follow up. But my guitar player used to play with Doug Feiger, though. He was a good force. We lost him a few years ago, unfortunately.
But
I definitely related to that revisiting of the 60s, you know, that energy and that kind of simple 3-chord, 4-chord power pop, like you say. I mean, I still, you know, a lot of bands, Cheap Trick was that to me, and a lot of bands, late 70s, I go back, you know, early mid 70s, like the Raspberries and Big Star, bands that kind of turned that Beatles thing up a little bit and you know, kept to the 3 or 4 minute song, that I did embrace a lot.
So in Valley Girl, were you and Nick Cage supposed to be punks? Is that what you were supposed to be? Or
well, it's funny because there wasn't really that great of a difference between the Valley and Hollywood. It was more created through, you know, clothes style, and, you know, the music was not that radically different. What a lot of people don't know is that X was supposed to be the Hollywood band officially, and they backed out for some reason. And then they got the Plimsolls, which I was happy about because I was a huge Plimsolls fan. You know, of note too, I did go on to play with a couple of guys in the Plimsolls in another band in the early 90s called The Moon. And we did a brief tour of the Southwest and played South by Southwest. So I did kind of carry on with those and got to know them all and did something with one or the other. You know, the other ones that I didn't do that band with, I did something with. And Peter Case is still a huge hero of mine as a songwriter and singer. But I digress. What were we talking about?
So, yeah, so X was supposed to be the band. That would make more sense. It seems like, you know, you guys were presented as kind of these punk guys, but then, like, there's the part where you're driving in the car and Nicolas Cage's like, I love this song. And I don't remember what the song is, but it doesn't seem like the kind of song that that character would like.
Yeah, I remember it was Pat Travers.
And right.
I mean, it was not, I'll just say, neon colors, new wave kind of KROQ music. So it was almost KLOS, which was the kind of hard rock station around here. So yeah, I mean, the music thing and the clothes thing was kind of created by Martha, the director, to just kind of delineate one side of the hill from the other here in LA.
Right.
Colors, things like that. So, you know, a lot of that was created in the movie, and I guess somewhat successfully, because the movie, you know, succeeded as long as you presented. I think visually she did kind of present a different culture, one from the other. But it was kind of created too for the movie.
Yeah. It's funny to watch it now, because back then it probably seemed kind of extreme the way the Valley Girls talked, but now it doesn't even seem strange at all. You know, it doesn't even feel that exaggerated, really, you know?
There's a screening next week. It's like a 36 year anniversary. And I've seen it a few times recently, you know, big. And the thing that really always strikes me about it are the colors are so cool, because that was shot on stock footage. You know, the movie was done on a shoestring. And so Martha shot on stock footage. So we had to kind of have there weren't many takes for most scenes. But something about that gave the film a really cool color. And Frederick Elms, who shot David Lynch's movies, he shot it. So, you know, she had some good people doing favors for her and, you know, pulling that together. So we did. We had good mojo on that one.
Yeah, there's a lot of great music. I love Josie Cotton, too. And
yeah.
And like the Bonnie Hayes song, Shelley's Boyfriend, is from that. And I have the soundtrack on vinyl only has like 5 or 6 songs on it, I think. But then they came out with a CD, I think, in the late 90s that had more.
I think, you know, when they were putting that together and, you know, before the movie came out and even did well or had time to do well, I think they just didn't have the dough or hadn't sealed all the deals or something. That was my understanding. But I will say, you know, when we were making the movie, the one thing I did have faith in was the soundtrack, because I knew, you know, the songs Martha was going for, and I thought, great, because you know, that was important to me even then. But yeah, and it's always a great compliment to me to hear, you know, that had the best soundtrack, and I'm like,
they put out a CD that was an expanded edition of it. I remember it. Like, it had Little Girl's Earthquake song, which is really great.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and, you know, Josie Cotton, her album Convertible Music is awesome, so it's fun to see her in the movie.
She was good. Apparently she's going to be there at this screening next week. And I'm going to try to make it. Yeah, it's one of those with a Q&A. Quentin Tarantino is a big fan of the movie, I guess. And he has a theater here in L.A. So he always screens it on the anniversary.
Okay.
So Yeah, but she's supposedly going to be there. And one of the guys, David from the Plimsolls, I heard is going to show up, which was kind of drawing me to it closer because I used to be in a band with David. So we may have a little reunion there next week.
Cool. Yeah, that's awesome. It seems like you have all the biggest laughs in the movie. Like all the lines that made me laugh were yours, I think, pretty much.
So you want to dance?
In another life.
Yeah, I didn't either. I was just taking a poll.
Do you think a girl should pet on the first date?
Who are you, Bozo the Clown?
What's your sign?
So, how's your mother?
She's dead.
Yeah, it's funny because some of them were actually mine.
Yeah.
I'd either used them or heard them from somebody else. Or yeah, it was funny. That being my first movie, I didn't know that you had kind of leeway to, you know, insert your own thing into it, your own words or lines. Or, you know, I came from the theater, which, you know, everything that's written is gospel. You know, you stay with it. And some, you know, some filmmakers, they still adhere to that rule of, you know, we keep to the script and don't deviate. But most, I mean, many do say, Hank, no, go create your own thing. And, you know, and Valley Girl was a lot of those party moments. It's like, all right, well, what can we do here? And so, yeah, so a lot of those were just things I threw in. And
I watched Body Rock a couple weeks ago, and I don't know if I had ever seen that before, but that movie is insane.
Isn't it? You know, it's funny because in hindsight, on paper, that was, you know, this is almost the opposite of Valley Girl. It's Valley Girl on paper. You're like, oh, really? But it was, you know, crafted well with Martha, you know, directing us and rehearsing us. Body Rock, on the other hand, on paper was actually a good script. I just thought it was kind of miscast. I mean, me included. And I just thought it was cast very kind of white. you know, I mean, I shouldn't have even been in it, you know, and Lorenzo Lamas was kind of their idea.
Oh my God. Lorenzo Lamas is just so strange to watch in that movie. It's really weird.
It was, you know, again, it was the 80s. So their presentation of this urban world, you know, I was like, wow, really? And
yeah.
I was like, I was like, I shouldn't even be in this. And, but I mean, the plus thing was that, the great dancers, I mean, we had Michael Jackson's dancers. And so that part of it kind of, you know, had some integrity, I thought. And the way it was shot, because it was Robbie Mueller, who was Wim Wenders. He was non-union at the time, so we got him.
Wow, okay.
And who else? Ray, what was Ray? Can't remember his name. Ray Sharkey, who was a great actor, was in it. He played kind of the, you know, the manager, the evil guy.
Right, right.
So it had some things, and the, you know, again, the colors, the way it was shot was visually great. Somebody recently, like in the last year, contacted me and they said, hey, will you come, we have this thing where we show movies and we, you know, basically take the piss out of them because we know every line, and
right,
and we're gonna show Body Rock, will you come? And at first, you know, this is by way of email, and I was like, fuck no, I'm not gonna come. But then I thought, you know what, this could be fun. And it was in my neighborhood. It was not, you know, in Hollywood. So I went. I had a ball. I mean, they all knew every line and were, you know, just watching it kind of. So I drank a beer with them and answered goofy questions. And it was a lot of fun, actually. It's funny to me. I mean, you know, most any film or any fans of films that I've done know the film and the lines so much better than I do.
Yeah.
I mean, I, you know, once I do something, I it's gone. I don't remember it.
Lorenzo Lamas just seems so out of his element. I don't know if that's accurate, yeah, but it just felt that way to me.
Well, he's an interesting guy. I mean, I've run into him here and there. I mean, he was doing kind of Falcon Crest or Nighttime Soap, but he did, you know, genuinely have kind of a street, you know, he rode bikes and stuff. So he, you know, motorcycles, I mean, and so he's aware of a certain culture, but I don't know that hip hop was his culture. you know, I don't. So yeah, I mean, you know, however it came out, but like I say, if you watch it from a certain perspective, yeah, it's pretty entertaining. Yeah. And those clothes too. I was like, geez.
Yeah, the clothes are insane.
Yeah, the '80s was a visually a very loud decade.
Yeah, and then in the film they just like, you know, multiply that by 10 times or whatever, just make it even more ridiculous than real life. So then
yeah.
Well, and you know, another example would be your hairstyle in Scenes from the Gold Mine is pretty interesting.
Well, you know what happened there? I did a back-to-back with that. I did this mini series called Dress Gray, which was about a military academy. So I had to, and the way it was scheduled, I was supposed to do Scenes from the Gold Mine first, then whack all my hair off and do the Dress Gray. But somehow they got reversed. So in essence, what happened was I had a very short haircut. I mean, I had, you know, my normal hair was kind of rock and roll hair, and, you know, it would have been fine that way, except it got rescheduled. So what we did was it was a weave. You know, now it's kind of common, these extensions
right.
that they sewed into my scalp, into very short hair on the back, which, you know, fit the time period. It was kind of a crazy mullet, long mullet.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think Thompson Twins. I mean, there were guys who kind of, you know, would rock that look.
Right.
I mean, it's a ridiculous look now when I look back on it, which I kind of appreciate in a way because it was so extreme. And, you know, again, the character of Niles Dresden was not me, you know.
Yeah, no.
So it makes a clear,
yeah, that's true,
delineation between me and the character, the hair, you know, every role. I was just working on something. I said, you know, every role begins and ends with the hair. I mean, let's face it. So
such a great name, Niles Dresden. That is great.
Yeah. Yeah. That was one thing that came up. It's funny. That script, in hindsight, it was not. All in all, Scenes from the Gold Mine to me had some great people in it. Catherine Mary Stewart, I see occasionally. You know, who else? We had Joey Pantoliano, Joey Pants, as he's known.
Yeah.
Who's brilliant. Steve Railsback, who was a hero of mine from, you know, Stuntman. And who else? Lee Ving.
Yeah, he was the video director. Yeah.
Oh, my God. And he was brilliant. So funny. And just, yeah, a wacky guy. So all these brilliant kind of actors. And the script, you know, again, the idea, okay. The script to me was not the strong point of it. But the guys who made it, Danny and Mark, Danny being the producer, Mark being the director, Mark Rocco, Danny Eisenberg, you know, they put this thing together, and they wanted to make a movie, and they had a dream and a vision behind it. And, you know, they included me. I said, great. And, you know, that's what it was. And it has kind of a weird following. Somebody like yourself, or just randomly, I'll get the odd fan who's like just such a fan of the movie and the music and everything. And I'm like, wow, well, that's great. You know, somebody saw it. Good.
Yeah. Well, why wasn't there a soundtrack? There must have been plans or hopes to have a soundtrack, right?
Yeah, there was. In fact, there was big, you know, they were going to send me out with a band to kind of promote it. It was Hemdale was the production company. And I don't know the mechanics of what happened with that or why there was no soundtrack. I haven't even popped it into a cassette player to see if it still plays, but I have those songs on a cassette, specifically the ones I did, because people have asked me, you know, I said, you know, I have this, and I haven't even, if I was smart, I would kind of put it on a cloud or something just to keep it. But I don't know where that exists. I mean, I can tell you we did the recording at Sound City, which is now kind of famous.
Really?
Sound City.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was during we made it, what, 86? It was that kind of lull period before Nirvana recorded their albums there and kind of put it back on the map. You know, Tom Petty would still record there. In fact, you know, shortly after we did our thing there, I made friends with Paola Salvatore, who would kind of manage the place, and I'm still friends with her. But she, remember her calling me saying, "Hey, Tom's," you know, and I was a huge Tom Petty fan, and Bob Dylan was here. I was like, "God." So I got to go kind of hang out outside and kind of listen, you know, to what he was doing, which was great. And who else? Like Donovan was there at the time, you know, which is cool for me. And then Michael DeBar had this band with Steve Jones from the Sex Pistols.
Yeah, Checkered Past.
Yeah, they were down the hall recording.
Yeah.
And I remember, yeah, Steve Jones bummed a cigarette for me, and I thought, wow.
Wow.
I felt so, you know, uncool. But
I think what Checkered Past had guys from Blondie in it too, right? I think.
Did they? Was Clem Burke, was he the drummer?
Yeah, I think, or Nigel Harrison, I think.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Okay. Yeah, I just remember they were down the hall. So it was, you know, Sound City was cool. And where was I going with that? The music. So, yeah. So, and Bobby Woods was the more or less the musical coordinator. I don't know if he got producer or that credit for being producer. And he would be the one who would know that stuff. And I'm out of touch with him. And as you mentioned, did you try to get in touch with him? Or somebody recently said, I've tried to get a hold of Bobby Woods and couldn't.
I probably tried to find him. But yeah, with a name like that, it's so hard to.
Yeah, right.
Because there's so many, you know.
Bobby did. It was either before this film or shortly after. He and his friend Chip Caramella. But they had written a song for Madonna and made some dough from it.
Oh, okay.
And I can't even tell you which song.
Okay.
So they made some money from it. So if you look up, I mean, that's a potential link for you right there.
Right.
But he would know, and he would also know the players because he assembled that, who actually played on those songs.
Yeah, and he wrote, Bobby Woods wrote I Was Just Asking, which I think is an amazing song.
Yeah, he wrote that. And the other one I sang called Every Good Girl Falls, which I think is the very first song in the film.
Right.
The band's rehearsing, and Pam Springsteen. That's Pam Springsteen.
Who played, Bruce's sister.
The former girlfriend. Yeah, she was a friend of mine too.
Right.
So, yeah, that old scene. It's funny. I haven't seen that movie in a long time, so talking about it kind of conjures it up.
Yeah, she was an actress in like a couple horror movies or something, right? Pamela Springsteen.
Yeah. She flirted with it. Now, in fact, I saw her just not so long ago. She's a photographer, a great photographer. She's done a lot of the pictures you see of Bruce. I know she did a good session with Keith Richards that I'm familiar with. And even back then, she would just be into taking pictures. And she's definitely got her own unique style. You can probably look her up on Facebook or something, her page, but so she's doing great. She has a daughter, I know, and she's doing good. I just recently got together with her after a long, long time. It's good to see her.
Cool. Yeah, it's funny how she turns up in the movie, just somebody random like that.
yeah
I Was Just Asking is to me just such a really well-written power pop song. I really love that song.
Yeah, that is a good pop song. And Kathy, you know, sings on that.
The other song, Listen to My Heartbeat, or Listen to the Heartbeat, I couldn't read who wrote that song in the credits, but that's a great song, too.
Was that James House?
Yeah, it's something like that. I just couldn't make out what the name was.
I think that's James House, who also appeared in the film. He was one of the... there were like three bands doing Twist and Shout.
Yeah, that was funny.
I think they picked that song because it was cheap or something.
Yeah.
It's the song that everybody's doing. But yeah, James was the one who acted British. And I said, no, his dad sells cars in Van.
Oh, the guy that came up to you in the club and was talking?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, that's the guy that wrote that song. Oh,
right.
Niles Love. How are you?
Hey, Simon. Mate. Long time.
I'm doing pretty good.
I should say so. I've heard that Rush Records is after you, lads.
Yeah, what can I say? We're pretty high right now. So how's your record song? You playing tonight?
We're back at Barnes West. Why don't you fall back later? Plus one, love.
Yeah. Debbie, this is Simon Legree, lead singer for Roberto Roberto.
I shan't hear any more. Bye-bye. See you later, love.
Good seeing you.
That was interesting.
Yeah, I think refreshing gets it better. We should go catch him, though. Believe it or not, we grew up together.
When?
Grade school. Shit, we had our first band seventh grade. We were doing the whole Alice Cooper trip, that kind of thing.
Old buddies, huh?
Anyway.
What does that mean?
Nothing. It's not important.
Well, if it's not important, then you can tell me.
Oh, man. Oh, hey, look at the guy. He's never spent a day of his life in England. His dad makes Camaros out in Van Nuys. Our band was doing pretty cool. And the second British invasion came around, he copped that accent, started dressing like a drag queen. Now he's selling records.
Well, you don't have to go see him if you don't want to.
That's okay. I'm over that. I mean, there's enough in it for all of us, you know? Besides that, we got 2 free drinks coming.
Let's hear a warm welcome for Niles, Dresden, and the Pieces.
And then, of course, we had the Bryan Adams, Jim Vallance songs.
Yeah.
You know, the kind of B songs of theirs, which I was a big Bryan Adams fan at the time. I think he just had a great voice. Still has. I mean, I think he's out touring again, but that excited me. So, and that was Play to Win. And then No Way to Treat a Lady. I think that's my favorite. I like No Way to Treat a Lady.
1, 2, 3, 4. You can tease me. You can sweet talk and lead me on. But believe me, won't be long till I'm catching on.
You know, that song was recorded by both Bonnie Raitt and Bonnie Tyler.
Oh, I knew Bonnie Raitt recorded it, but I didn't know Bonnie Tyler.
And Play to Win, Ian Lloyd had a band called Fast Forward that put that song out in like 1984. So I knew that song. I have that record. That's a great song.
All right, you guys are going to be hearing a lot of this next one. It's called Play to Win.
Saw your friends kind of thinking that it's all thrown up.
later, Brad. And the pieces want to meet you. Enough on the beige is the man who puts People Magazine's 10 best dress list to shame. Girls, we call him the Iceman. He's from Tupelo, Mississippi. That's right, Tupelo. Mr. Dennis Alavero! Yes, and plumbing the keyboards is quite a lady. And she'll write words that'll break your heart. Beverly Hills has never produced anything so wild and innocent, luscious and lovely as Miss Debbie D'Angelo! Young man back there bashing the drums with so much class and lots of sass. It's not my uncle, but we call him Dino the Dinosaur, and he's from Sunland, California. Mr. Kenny Barnes, talk to me. And in case you might have been wondering who I was, my name's Nas Dresden. I'll be seeing you again, but just remember something.
Well, it also.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Oh, there's another, shoot, there was another Bryan Adams song that I thought.
Yeah,
oh,
don't
that,
let him know Adams and Valance wrote.
Right, you're right, right, right. But I'm thinking there's another Bryan Adams song that Bryan Adams did that sounds a lot like Play to Win. It's like, oh, this was kind of the template.
Oh, maybe. Yeah, maybe.
Anyway. But yeah, all fun to do, and you know, Timothy Schmidt and John Cord Coley.
Yeah, that's your rhythm section in the pieces. Yeah,
I mean, you know, John Cord Coley was an interesting choice because he, you know, England Dan, John Cord Coley.
Yeah,
I'd love to see you.
Right.
I know, he's drunk, but he was friends with Mark, the director. So he was a great guy. And then Timothy, who, you know, Timothy's the one of the Eagles who anybody who's ever met Timothy is like, God, he's the sweetest guy. You know, some might say something about this Eagle or that Eagle, but Timothy's yeah. The one that, yeah. And it was during the Eagles period where nobody was talking to each other, but everybody talked to Timothy because he's just the greatest guy in the world. And still is, as far as I know. I wound up doing a video of his. A couple of years later, one of his solo project things. I never got to see it, I don't think. But it was fun to do. Flattered that he asked me to do it. It's called Boys Night Out. I remember that.
Yeah, so I guess John Ford Coley had been in some other movies in the 80s too. But
I think he kind of caught the bug with this one. And
okay.
I know he did... Mark Rocco, he did another one of Mark's movies that he directed, I remember. But from there, I don't know. I hope he's doing well these days. I remember he got married around that time. I remember going to his wedding.
I have a friend named John Lamoureux who does a podcast called The Hustle, and he said he just recently interviewed him.
Oh.
Because I told him that I was talking to you and I was telling him about this movie, and I told him that John Ford Coley was the drummer in your band, and he's like, I just interviewed him. I wish I would have known that to ask him about that.
It's a good detail.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I like John, you know, he wasn't a drummer by nature, or that wasn't his job in the band he was in. So
yeah.
He had to kind of figure that out. And Timothy, of course, you know, was a bass player playing a bass player, so that was easy.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So I guess that band never actually played?
No. No, I don't know what that would have sounded like.
Yeah.
Actually. They, Mark, Mark and Danny, they did have me prepped. They said, hey, this movie's going to open in Cleveland, and we want you to have a band together. And I had it. I had a band together, a good one. Some Plimsolls guys, some you know, other guys from here and there. But that didn't come to pass, because I was going to do, you know, songs from the movie that I did, and then, you know, whatever else around that, some covers, 60s covers, or, you know, things that I liked. But like I say, it did not come to pass. So, you know, that was that.
So that was like, if the movie had actually gotten some traction, then you would have done that probably.
Yeah. Yeah.
And since there wasn't even a soundtrack, kind of put a damper on it.
Yeah, no, it got, you know, in the end, the release was kind of low key, and, you know, I don't think I'd put that much weight on it. I mean, I, you know, it was great to me because I was doing the two things that I do, you know. I mean, I am a singer and you know, a legit singer, a legit rock and roll singer, I'll say that. And, you know, a legit actor and was working a lot in those days. And, you know, so it all fit for me. I was like, oh God, this is doing both things. This is great. And, you know, I think I did have some hopes. It's like, well, you know, to be visible doing both is a good thing. But then, like I say, it didn't, you know, it didn't have the traction. That's a good word that, you know, any of us thought it might have. So, you know, you move on.
Yeah, it must have been disappointing, because for one thing, these are great songs. It would have been a great soundtrack.
Yeah.
And you must have put a lot of work in the studio into, you know, recording all this music, and you must have envisioned it being more than just in the movie.
Yeah, I think so. You know, it's funny, as a learning experience. Like Purple Rain, you know, which I consider, you know, rock and roll movie around that time, or I won't say rock and roll, R&B, whatever Prince was. But, you know, those songs had exposure around the movie. With Scenes from the Goldmine, you had songs that nobody had ever heard, except for Twist and Shout, or, yeah, I think that's the only one. And also, And just as a, if I had to, you know, critique a little bit, you let those songs play out probably longer than you should have. You know, maybe just a verse of something to catch an ear would have been better to say, ooh, yeah, that kind of sounds good. I've never heard it, but, you know, I want to hear more of it. I mean, you may argue with this, and I welcome that. But to me, it's like, you know, you had a whole movie of songs that nobody had ever heard before. And maybe giving them a little too much of that song, or having to sit through, you know, a song that they'd never heard, or many of them. So that was part of my critique of the movie, that, you know, you maybe lingered a little too long on, you know, a song that wasn't familiar, or many songs that weren't familiar.
Yeah, you're right. There's so many like entire songs in the film, but it's also a blessing because there's no soundtrack. So at least we have the songs.
That's right. You want to hear the whole song. You got to watch. Yeah. I think, I mean, you know, knowing those guys, they were probably getting their money's worth. Like, well, you know, we paid for these. So let's get the most out of them.
And there was a way to pad the movie.
Sure. Sure. Yeah,
because they already have these strange storylines that just go off on tangents that it doesn't really seem to coalesce well.
Yeah,
it just kind of seems like cliches, almost. Like, she's got her friend who has an abortion. She's got her brother who commits suicide. Yeah, yeah. There's all this stuff going on.
No, I sometimes call it, if I have to kind of sum it up for anybody who's never, I said it was kind of like a rock and roll soap opera,
yeah,
you know, you know, in movie form. Yeah, because they really did go for all the drama events, but you know, again, good actors kind of handling those things, which made it more reasonable, I think. And then I, you know, what I really appreciated was were the actors who made it fun and funny, like Joey and Lee Bing.
Yeah, yeah. The whole video shoot was great. The way John was so upset because they were trying to shave his beard off and stuff.
Yeah, yeah. All that stuff. There was a woman named Lotus Weinstock, a great comedian who was in that, who's passed since. And her daughter is a great violin player, Lily Hayden, who's played with everybody. Yeah, Lily I met when she was like little, when Lotus did that movie, because I went and saw her. She did a stand up, and I went and saw her a couple of times, and Lily came up with her when she was a little kid. And then some years passed, and I saw Lily, who's grown into this beautiful woman and just this stunning kind of presence on violin. I was like, wow. And Lotus said, oh yeah, that's Lily. I was like, oh, gosh. Yeah. Wow. But yeah, I see her around. She's cool. But yeah, Lotus sadly passed some time ago, but she was another funny part of that. She was the one who, she was the makeup artist, I think, in that. The whole thing about, you know, it's how you look, her thing. But Lee Vang, hilarious. And I just remember him, you know, doing ADR stuff, just putting in lines that you just hear randomly, and just coming up with this ridiculously funny, you know, thing about, you know, all these British guys, you know, and they all got the crabs, and I thought, that's what I want to do. Just like going off on these tangents and
cheerleaders, thunder, lightning, scantily clad women who are voluptuous. You getting a picture? No!
He had a great add in line. There's the party scene, you know, and I've got this outrageous kind of costume with the, the velvet jacket and the, shirt, ascot, and the ridiculous hair and all that. And so there's the scene where we show up at his house, right? It was this house up in the hills. Lee Vang's the video producer, and he says, ah, yes, the pieces. And he's like, who are the pieces? But he threw in a sideline. He meets me, and he's like, oh, yeah, put my luggage over there. I just appreciated him. It was funny.
At the end, it's so disappointing because they start to play the video, and they even have like the MTV white letters in the corner that says everything, and you're like, awesome, I want to see the video. Then it cuts off after like 10 seconds.
Yeah. I think that was all they did. I remember it was my birthday when I did that, and they had a stripper for me. I just remember I was in that kind of ridiculous spaceman outfit being kind of lap danced by this stripper on that set. And it's an odd memory I have, but it happened.
Yeah, that's just the beginning of the video. Is Catherine's got the pom poms, and you kick through the wall behind her, and then that's it. They don't show the rest.
The space helmet's on. Yeah. Yeah. Oh God, you're making me want to see this now. I haven't seen it in a while, but yeah, I remember that.
the funniest part in the whole movie is there's an old lady with a walker crossing the street, and a car pulls up that has to stop and wait for her, and the person in the car yells, "Your family hates you."
that was Lotus. That was Lotus.
Oh, that was Lotus. Yeah. That line is hilarious.
Yeah, she's good.
Your character turns into such a prick by the end of the movie.
And I'm the nicest guy now. It's funny. I guess around that, or I don't know, somewhere in the mid 80s, things took a turn and I started playing all these bad guys. And it's funny. I have a friend who kind of psychic, you know, does that stuff. And I check in with her I used to more. And I said, what is it with all these bad guys? And she said, you know what it is, the way I see it, you don't get mad in life. That's kind of your safe place to do it. And I thought, oh. And then it became a lot of fun. I was like, well, yeah. And, you know, any bad guy's subtext is, why does nobody get this but me? You know? <it's,
laughs> yeah.
And, you know, so when you open yourself up to that, it's playing bad guys is kind of fun, or became even more fun. But yeah, I mean, that was, it was a little sensitive to me at the time because, you know, I play music and I didn't want this guy to be confused with me. And
I remember see that
being somewhat conscious of that. You know, I don't wear leather pants and have the mullet and no shirt. That's not my guy. But certainly, yeah, if he came across bad, that's good.
But yeah, that's true. It's like you put this subconscious image in people's minds and then they see you playing music and they're like, that's that asshole that steals people's songs.
Right. Well, yeah, it's funny because I did, you know, to get more visible locally, there was a lapse of time between that movie and, you know, my playing around town, I think. And I, you know, again, it's such the random person who saw the movie, so it's not like it it made it into everybody's living rooms or, you know, hearts and minds. So
it's funny that, you know, they set it up so that the sleazy manager guy is the guy that convinces you to steal her songs, but then the end you're just on your own stealing the song she wrote about her dead brother.
Right.
Oh, I mean, how low is that?
Drive it home. I know.
But then she hits you in the back with an electric guitar, which would not feel good.
I think she does win in the end. That looked good. I remember that whole flying into the audience being whacked by a guitar made of balsa wood, I think it was made of.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it must have been a really lightweight. Right? If it was a real guitar, you would probably ended up in a wheelchair from that scene.
Yeah, right. Right. Yeah, it would have been more than a couple of ribs cracked.
Hey, listen, save me a beer. I got something I got to take care of.
I don't normally do, but tonight feels good, and you guys feel good. This is a brand new one that I wrote with Debbie.
How could you leave without saying goodbye and giving me the chance to look in your eyes and say, where are you going? Where are you going? One touch would have lasted.
Yeah.
Oh, and that song, that was written by Melissa Etheridge, that song.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And Melissa at the time, she was actually in the movie. I think she got cut out. She played like a store owner of.
Yeah. You know, I saw her in the credits, but I couldn't remember seeing her in the movie. So you're right.
That's what it was. I think they clipped her. I don't know why.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was something legal because Melissa was just. I think she was just doing her first album around that time or after. I remember seeing her in a club and just going, I mean, I loved her, you know, her voice I just related to, and she was very down to earth and just cool. And, you know, I remember we talked about, you know, waking up at the same hour. She goes, we should be married. And I thought, well, that's not going to happen. But, yeah, I mean, not because I wouldn't have, but you know, anyway, I just liked her a lot, and we were lucky to have her. I mean, especially now in hindsight.
Yeah, I looked it up. Her first album came out in '88, so she didn't even have an album out yet when the movie happened.
It's funny because I remember I was just remembering this the other day because I had her number and I, you know, some time had passed and I called her while she was recording the album. And she kind of said, well, why are you calling? And I said, well, I was just, you know, seeing how you're doing. Are you okay? And And I think at that point things had kind of started to spin for her a little bit. So, you know, she almost took it like I was like being an opportunist or something, calling her. And I honestly was just kind of calling to see, you know, God, what are you doing now? Because I didn't know about the record or anything. That was an odd memory I had the other day.
People probably, well, I mean, you probably had it happen to you too, where you get bombarded with.
Oh yeah.
With,
I understand it. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, what do you want? but honestly, I was just checking in.
The one other person I wanted to ask you about was Nick Gilder, because I'm a huge fan of Nick Gilder, and he's got a song listed in the credits, which I don't know where it is in the movie, but it's a song he never released as far as I know.
Is that right? Because it's a great song. It's one of the few that, you know, we didn't do or I didn't do that I remember. It's like digging at a rock from a gold
mine. Yeah, it says rock in the gold mine. Yeah, yeah.
That's what it is. And yeah, it's great because, you know, Nick Gilder, you know, Hot Child in the City, has that kind of high, you know, feminine. But this, he kind of sings more, you know, dead on rock and roll. Kind of, it was a great song. In fact, I was, you know, when I first heard, that's Nick Gilder. And he was a great guy. I remember, really pleasant, nice guy, Nick.
Yeah, he introduces your video at the end.
Right.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
That was fun.
Yeah, that's like a lost song because it's not on any of his records. So it's like, would have been on the soundtrack, I guess, but.
I guess it would have, yeah.
I don't think it's been released in any way as far as I can tell.
I think Nick too was he was a client of Joe. Shoot, if you watch the Sound City documentary that Dave Grohl put together, they talk about Joe who ran it. He was one of his clients, as well as Rick Springfield was kind of the most famous client of his. And it's funny, I remember somebody said, you know, Joe's interested in managing you. And I thought, oh, man, I don't want to be Rick Springfield. It's like, one of those things I probably shouldn't have done maybe at the time. I don't know.
Did you ever have a record deal or?
Never have. Recorded. I've had some great opportunities. I mean, I've recorded some of the best studios in L.A. there. And in the earlier 80s at the Record Plant, somebody gave me some time there. And then in the 90s at the Village Recorder, great place. You know, interestingly enough, Timothy, the Eagles were recording their comeback album down the hall there when I was in there. So I've made recordings through the years and some really good ones. You know, my problem is I'm already on to the next thing. It's like, well, you know, all right, I'm not going to put that out. So I've got this, you know, back stock of stuff I've recorded that maybe one day I'll actually get my shit together and just, you know, these days you can just put it out there on whatever way. But and I'm always kind of working on newer stuff. I am right now. There's like an EP's worth of my last band, the Match Fingers. That's out there floating around on CD Baby and so it's available. You know, I'm in the process of kind of putting down more stuff, and I'm always writing stuff too. So you ain't heard the last of me.
but like back in the 80s, were you trying to get a record deal? Were you trying to do go that route? Yeah.
Yeah, I would go back and forth. Like, oh, this is what I'm doing now. You know, I can't let acting get in the way of this. This is what I'm focused on. Yeah, somebody had given me time. Danny Goldberg, who became kind of a big deal, was a friend of my agent. So he gave me time at the Record Plant. I went in there, you know, wanting to do a whole album with the day that he gave me, you know. In hindsight, probably I should have done 3 or 4 or 2 or... but I just blasted through, you know, some originals of mine, a bunch of covers. And he's like, what the fuck are you doing? But that, you know, there was that. And like I say, during period, then what I recorded at the Village, I actually was pursuing a record deal, and it kind of got here and it got here. But then when my sons was born, and that kind of turned me, in another direction. So things would come up and I'd kind of walk, but, And that's also at a time when people were starting to kind of, you know, do it themselves, put their own records together. So then I left it long enough to not really get with that. So, you know, I'm always, it's like the playing music. What I love doing more than anything, I think, is playing live. I mean, that's just so direct and so, you know, I connect best that way. And I'd still like to, the band I have now, the idea was to go and record them live. One of us got sick, so that kind of put the kibosh on that. But now we're kind of piecing it together and recording that way.
So what is your band now?
The Match Fingers, basically a band I've played with mostly in the same configuration for, God, the last 20 years. It's two guitars, bass, drums, fiddle. More roots, I'll say. Americana is kind of the common tag these days. But I'll say kind of folk rock with a good backbeat. And, you know, I still sing with some oomph. So that gives it more of the rock and roll thing. So that basically. But I'd say, you know, musically, between 1965 and 1974 is kind of where we breathe, you know, where we live, that style. So, you know, when we play live, we throw a lot of those kind of covers in. Not the obvious covers, but, you know, yeah, ones that we like. The whole band's kind of that era in their upbringing. But then, you know, yeah, and I've written quite a bit and continue to do that and will.
Yeah, that's great. I could tell just from watching this movie that even though I didn't really know what your story was as far as like a musician or being in bands, it just seemed kind of obvious that you must have pursued that as well. It was obvious you weren't just an actor pretending, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's funny. Shortly after this movie, there was a movie I was supposed to do, and my agent called me and said, I don't know how to tell you this, but you're not doing it. They bought you out. And I said, what? And I didn't take offense because I hadn't done anything on it. But he said, they're paying you. I said, how? And I always had this fantasy of going over to England and the UK, where all my heroes were from, and just playing like Hank Williams. I was getting into Hank Williams and stuff like that. And, you know, Dylan, of course, just playing American music over there and in the tunnels and pubs. And so Friday I split and I went for like 2 months. This was not long after Season with Goldmine. And just busked. I mean, I really kind of learned the fine art of busking and just popping up in pubs. They're like, oh, you know, Dylan, you know, they'd sing along with you and stuff. Or Hank Williams, an American playing that stuff was kind of a turn on to them.
Wow.
So, I think that's kind of where I got more of my legs as a guitar player, singer, or you know, I'll say troubadour. And I still, you know, if I'm not playing with a band, I can perform on my own, you know, with relative ease. I keep sharp on that, you know, throw a harmonica rack on my neck and I'm, you know, on my own little band.
Cool. Do you do that? Do you play a lot of gigs?
I do. You know, the band was pretty active there for quite a while. We'd play like once a month. These days, a little less. I just turned 60 the other couple of weeks ago, and I played a gig around that with the band and then other people that I'd played with before that band. There was kind of a configuration of, it was a little more acoustic. It's like a bass, acoustic guitar, fiddle. Then a friend of mine, Matt Cartsonis, who would play everything. I mean, he could play accordion, he could play banjo, he could play slide. Great guy to have in your band. It was the four of us and occasionally with a drummer. So it was a little more kind of acoustic, but you know, again, I sing with some oomph, so you know, I call it gut folk. So, but it's a pleasure talking to you, Brian. Thanks for, you know, tracking me down, pursuing this.
Yeah, I really appreciate you, you know, indulging me in this.
Sure, but otherwise, man, it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Cameron. It's been great.
All right, Brian. Good luck with everything.
Thank you.
Okay.
Okay. Bye.
Yeah.
Alright, so that was my conversation with Cameron Dye. I hope you enjoyed that. I know I did. And if you haven't guessed, the song we're hearing right now is Cameron's band, The Matchfingers. There's a 4-song EP available on Amazon. This is a song called Thick Skin. I want to thank Cameron Dye so much for coming on the podcast and telling us all his stories about making Scenes from the Gold Mine. And I hope you enjoyed all the great music from that film. And let's hear more of The Matchfingers.
And there's far too little time between care and dying. And on this day I swear I'll never curse again. All those that judge me hard and taught me that I'd sin. God bless each and every heart. Let me trade in my thick skin. Let me let my hair down. Chase away these black and blues from my eyes. Cause tonight I'm in the arms of this town. I will raise your cup with my best hand. Cast a star up in the sky. Watch my glass shoes fall safely to the ground. I'm an angel and I don't know why. I'm an angel and I don't know why.
Jesus Christ, you've changed, Niles. You keep shoving that shit up your nose.
I'm getting pretty fucking tired about hearing how much I've changed.